Welcome to Startup Health Now, the weekly web show that celebrates the healthcare transformers and change makers reimagining health. My name is Unity Stokes, and we are in San Francisco at the Wearable Tech and Digital Health Conference. We've got a very interesting show. We're going to be meeting with Dr. Philip Lowe, the CEO and founder of NeuroVigil. We're going to be talking about the exciting world of neurotechnology. Stick around. It's going to be a great show.
It is the duty of leaders to lead, of the creative to create, of the daring to do. The free world expects leadership of us. Its fate and our fate depends upon our leadership. We are industrious, inventive, restless, with the fires that burn within us. Well, I say that nothing is easy, and the best things are the hardest. And all our troubles, all our immense difficulties, now and in the future, can I say, be solved if we have the will, the courage. The future is to those who take it.
Welcome, Philip. It's great to be here with you.
Thank you.
So I thought we'd start the conversation learning about you, your passions, how you started as an innovator and entrepreneur in the health space. Take us back to the beginning.
All right. Terrific. Well, you know, thank you very much for having me today. It's a pleasure to meet you. And I'm honored to be able to share a little bit of my story. So the way it started was all, you know, by accident. When I was, you know, 10 years old, my father was thrown in jail because he threatened somebody with a weapon. And it was found sometime later that the pill that he was taking was actually responsible for his behavior. It's something that I didn't really believe at the time, but he was pardoned by the Swiss Cantonal Parliament. And very early on in my life, I understood that it was possible that pills could have a dramatic effect on people's physiology and behaviors. So I went to America shortly after my 16th birthday and enrolled in the University of Chicago, studied mathematics and physics as well. And there was another accident during my junior year. The faculty had forgotten to remove my name from a mailing list, which would go to all the biology students. I had taken the sequence in biology in my sophomore year, and they were looking for a student to go to Harvard Medical School to tinker over there and so on. But this was just for biology students, not for a math geek such as myself. And I had a theory that nobody wanted to listen to, and so I sent a little pamphlet to Harvard, and they chose me. So in 9 weeks, I was able to discover that a particular drug was actually very effective, and I didn't realize that this was very abnormal to have a result like that.
Pretty fast cycle there, yeah.
Exactly. And so what ended up happening is that, you know, in my next job, after I didn't have a good result in 9 weeks, I actually stopped cashing my paychecks because I thought I wasn't working hard enough. So I nearly got evicted from my apartment twice until some postdoc told the head of the lab that I wasn't paying myself. And then he said, Philip, it's called research for a reason. Right. So anyways, to make a long story short, what happened was at Harvard Medical School, I was very, very excited about all the beautiful living organisms that one could really study. But as a mathematician, I wanted some quantitative rigor. And so there was this new field called computational neuroscience that was emerging. And I wrote a letter to the only person I could think of after I'd enrolled in some graduate courses in computational neuroscience who knew a little bit about molecular biology, and he knew a little bit about computational neuroscience. That was Francis Crick, Nobel laureate in physiology and medicine. He knew a little bit about molecular biology because he discovered DNA or co-discovered it. And he knew quite a bit about neuroscience because he was now a neuroscientist running a program at the Salk Institute. So he invited me to do my PhD. And I turned him down because I thought I wasn't ready yet. And I stayed for a year in Chicago, worked on birds at that time who were so sleeping birds. I was looking at their brain rhythms. And then I accepted Francis's invitation, went to the Salk Institute. There was another accident, which is...
All these accidents.
That's right.
But they turn into beautiful opportunities.
So chance favors the prepared mind, right? So this is Pasteur, a very, very important quote. So that was exactly it. So I invented a new method to monitor brain activity in birds. and I found out that there wasn't an algorithm that was around to actually make sense of this data. So I invented the algorithm, and then from that point on, I said no to four offers from Caltech, Harvard, Max Planck, and Oxford, in order to start my own lab. They wanted me to start my own laboratory, but I ended up instead starting my company. So this is a very, very torturous path. I know you prefer a five-second answer.
No, it's very interesting. It sounds like one of the common themes I'm hearing here is that you take that chance. You write the letter. You contact the person you want to meet.
Sure.
You put yourself maybe in the same room as an expert or someone that inspires you. Have you always been that way? And what are your thoughts in terms of recommending that type of strategy to other entrepreneurs and innovators that are trying to really get started?
Sure. Well, I think that's a great question, and it's a very keen observation. I think there is no entrepreneurship without risk. So you have to be willing to take a risk, and you have to be willing to fail, and you have to be willing to sacrifice your entire personal life and your well-being. I mean, this is what it takes. This is why, you know, I sort of resent when the name entrepreneur and entrepreneurship is sort of used as a badge left and right. It really means being able to take a huge risk, you know. So absolutely, I would say go for it. You can get what you don't ask for. And if you're passionate about what you do, if you think that you can really change the world or you have a shot at it, then you will regret not trying as opposed to trying.
So let's dig in a little to NeuroVigil, your company,
right,
and starting with the mission. What is your mission?
Well, we had this conference right now, and you know the people who are presenting, most of them probably have healthcare and so on. It's sort of reasonable to assume that maybe 80% of them had their blood pressure checked, you know, in the last 2 years. What NeuroVigil is about is making it possible to check our brain activity not only once every 2 years, but chronically. And so with this algorithm that I created during my PhD, I was able to create a map of brain activity from a single EEG, electroencephalogram. So iBrain is this small device that actually does...
And that's one of your products.
Absolutely. That is a product that captures the electroencephalogram. And so in 2009, we did our first contract with Hoffmann-La Roche, big pharmaceutical company, to enable them to monitor the brain without bringing patients in the hospital. So we could actually avoid situations such as my father's and look at the effect that drugs were having on the brain in the clinical trial before a drug that might otherwise be, you know, desired for is released. So just empower people, give them more data. In 2010, we had an alliance with Stanford for autism. In 2011, we started working with Stephen Hawking. And this is a different wing of work that we're doing, which is to enable people who are completely paralyzed to communicate just using their mind. And I'll discuss this tomorrow in my lecture. And then subsequently, we've been approached by the senior care industry. And what we're doing now is we're releasing a device, another generation of iBrains, to actually enable seniors to be screened for early signs of Alzheimer's from their own retirement homes before they have any symptom.
Just based off of how they're thinking or their brain activity?
Based on the brain activity. So if we see that they have problems with their sleep patterns, which is one of the variables that is affected by Alzheimer's, then we will do an amyloid test, a spinal tap, an fMRI. And then if they're positive on all of those, then we know that statistically we have people who are highly likely to develop Alzheimer's. We want to be able to work with them before they actually have the disease absolutely documented, so that there are many drugs that may actually be neuroprotective early on in the disease as opposed to later on. So the idea is to go from a reactive art to a proactive science, map the brain, and empower people, because what will happen is, in this particular trial, we have a sponsorship for 10 million people, which is rather, you know, superlative just in terms of scope. But what will happen in these types of trials is that once we know that these people fail, you know, these tests, then we can get them that help. And again, that's crucial.
So this very exciting emerging field of neurotech, maybe share a little insight into what the future looks like as a result of these extraordinary innovations taking place. What are the practical implications for everyday people? We just talked about the Alzheimer's case, which is extraordinary. What are some of the other opportunities? What does the future look like as a result?
Absolutely. Well, you know, it's a great question. When I started in that field and I explained to people that I was in neurotech, they didn't understand what that meant. Now I go to conferences and I see neurotech everywhere. I ran the first international congress on Alzheimer's disease and advanced neurotechnologies, and people were begging me to drop the name neurotech from the title. And now it's sort of commonplace, so it's sort of funny how that works. Well, I think what will happen with neurotech is very exciting in the sense that we are now the cusp in neuroscience where we are going to actually be recording most of our data outside of the laboratory as opposed to inside of the laboratory, meaning the whole world is going to become a gigantic laboratory.
Is that because we're connected,
we've got
diagnostics?
And we have small probes, and we have algorithms that enable us to actually collect data from a tiny footprint. So imagine if, you know, there's election season right now, right? Imagine if you picked the President of the United States just by going into a room and sampling maybe 0.1% of the population, and based on that poll, you know, that's it. You know, 0.1% of the population in the room. In other words, something, you know, just a handful of people, and you pick the president. In a way, that's what we've been doing in neuroscience.
Right.
We've been sampling very, very few people and making huge models of the brain. Now we're going to be able to sample tens of thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people. And that will completely revolutionize the way we do clinical trials. One of the very interesting things that's been happening, if you look at the clinical trial literature, is the following. The control group does better and better. In other words, doctors are getting better and better, and individuals feel quite good, you know, after they go see their doctors. And so that's actually a huge problem, because there are a number of drugs that would actually do rather well, but they're lost in the noise because this control group is getting this big bump.
Right.
If you work with very small numbers of people, that can happen a lot. So what will happen with neurotech is that we will be able to sample large numbers of people, not force them to adhere to a particular regimen. As long as we know what they're doing, then we can run partial derivatives on the data and find out, you know, if it was a vitamin, if it was a drug, if it was an exercise regimen that actually caused them to improve. So we're going to, the whole world is going to become a laboratory, and we're going to have...
And will this improve people's well-being, their health as
Absolutely.
A result?
Absolutely, because we'll be able to measure everything, right? So big data is another one of those, you know, those words that people love to use. But so far, I mean, big data, you might not like this, but big data is like teenage sex. Everybody talks about it. Nobody knows how to do it. Everybody thinks that everybody else is doing it and nobody's doing it.
Right.
We're going to actually
Especially
now,
on the scale you're talking about.
That's right. We're going to get into big data now because we will have these tiny little probes that are going to go viral. So that will enable us to test a lot of hypotheses. It also means that we will be able to track people longitudinally over years. And if you look, for example, at the way things are done currently, right now, to get a drug to the market, you know, we spend per year $40 billion per year. This is industry, government, and academia. We sacrifice about 100 million vertebrates to do this. The probability that we will get a drug to be tested in humans is about 6%.
Right.
In the human trials, a third of those people are going to drop off because they can't stand being in the hospitals. All of that is going to change. There are plenty of nutraceuticals and supplements which actually have a real effect, and there are plenty of therapies. You know, in senior care homes, people know that there are a number of therapies that are very effective, but none of these things have been measured. Now, once we can actually measure all of these different things, we're going to have an arsenal of therapies that will improve people's health. And there's a lot of bogus stuff. We'll be able to say that's bogus, that doesn't work, but we will have the numbers. So at the end of the day, it's going to benefit individuals. And if you look right now, you know, when individuals purchase food in the supermarket, they look at, you know, labels very, very carefully. They don't do this yet with the drugs, right? Because they don't know exactly, they don't really think they have choices.
Right.
Once we empower individuals to know how they respond to these drugs, everything is going to change.
Fantastic. If people want to learn more about NeuroVigil or just neurotech in general, any places that you recommend they go to, books or journals or blogs or things that you would recommend other entrepreneurs, innovators should be paying attention to?
Sure. Well, you know, if in terms of our company, they can go to our website. If they're interested,
neurovigil.com,
absolutely. Okay. If they're interested in basic research, you know, there are plenty of centers around the country that are extremely advanced. The NIMH has done a very, very good job at sort of sharing some of the latest innovations with the world. If they're interested from an entrepreneurial perspective in terms of what is going on, nothing beats speaking to entrepreneurs. And that's why I think your show is such a wonderful service, you know, to these individuals, because they're learning by the entrepreneurs, and then through their websites they can contact them. So it's, again, you know, just like what I did, you write a letter, and you know, if you write something that excites that
just
a person,
go. Then I love it.
Just go for it.
So last question, what do you personally do to stay healthy? Maybe something that you think impacts the brain from your learning.
Right. Well, I sleep 4 hours, you know, so I had 4 hours of sleep last night. Actually, if you look at the amount of sleep that people, if you look at sleep versus mortality, it's sort of a U-shaped curve. So this idea that we need to sleep 8 hours to live longer, it's actually not true at all. But four is a little bit on the shorter side, but so it's a U-shaped curve.
So you don't want to be in the middle. You want to be either 8 hours or 4 hours.
No. You actually do want to be in the middle. That's right.
So 6 hours.
So 6 hours for many people, that's a good thing.
And every person's different, of course.
That's right. There isn't the one particular number for everybody. But what I do is I'm vegan. So that actually has been a tremendous thing for me. I have such a huge energy boost. Right now I didn't eat anything. I just had a Diet Coke. It's the first thing I had today. I slept 4 hours last night. I've been on the phone with Asia and with Europe all day long. And, you know, I'm not too tired. So that has given me a tremendous amount of energy. The other thing is, you know, as an entrepreneur, and I think that's sort of an important thing to do, it is very important to exercise. There will always be things that are last minute and things that we feel that we should be doing, but if you can't take care of yourself, you're not going to be able to take care of your company, your loved ones, you know, all those people who depend on you, all the patients that you're serving, your clients, your team members, your investors, and so on. So you have to be a rock for everybody else. It is a very, very lonely journey, but it is a possibility to change the world. It is a ticket to do that. So certainly taking care of yourself.
Well said, and thank you for everything that you're doing for the ecosystem and the future. It's very exciting.
Thank you. Nice to meet you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll see you soon.